Right on. Okay. So I titled my portion Unique Opportunities because, as Gary said, come 1961, the PSO did not have a recording contract. And this is my lead-in. You can read the details. This should probably scroll like in Star Wars in a galaxy far away. Anyway, Command Records was flush with cash and flush with success from making stereo spectacular records like Persuasive Percussion and Provocative Percussion. Command's founder, Enoch Light, was actually musically trained, liked classical music, and wanted to engage in classical recording. In 1958, he saw a performance of the Pittsburgh Symphony in Danbury High School, Danbury, Connecticut, which is 20 miles across the border from my house. And it's amazing to me that a major symphony orchestra performed at Danbury High School in the 1950s, but that's how the culture has changed. Steinberg met Enoch Light in his dressing room, which was a classroom, and Enoch Light said, "You know, you have a fantastic orchestra here, and I want to record you." Steinberg's answer was, "Well, I have a recording contract." And Enoch Light gave him his business card and said, "Well, when you don't, please give me a call." And that opportunity arose in 1961, and the call was made, and that thus began the 7-year relationship between the PSO and Command Classics. Enoch Light was a man of great marketing and big dreams and bold intentions. So this was his opening ad for Command Classics that was in all the hi-fi magazines and in newspapers. And he started out with two recordings in Pittsburgh. And if there's some familiarity in the sound quality with Everest, it's because this was exactly the same equipment that Everest had used just a year earlier. My father purchased Everest's recording equipment and studio, and he was Enoch Light's main engineer, and they devised a way that they were going to record in Pittsburgh. Now, I should thank Dennis right from the start here, because there's not very much photographic history of the PSO and Command Classics, but Dennis was kind enough to give me a bunch of old High Fidelity magazines, and High Fidelity did actually cover Command Classics, and that's where most of these photos come from. Note that Command Classics was designed for the most discriminating and demanding individuals, as opposed to anyone who could buy an LP record. Anyway, the first thing they did was decided the Syria Mosque was not usable for the recordings the way they wanted to do it. The reason is the stage in the Syria Mosque was actually built into a wall. As you can see, it's recessed in a wall. And there had been some experiments with shells and the like to project the sound out into the hall, but none of them were to Enoch Light's liking. So he and my father toured around Pittsburgh and looked at other venues, and they found Soldiers and Sailors Memorial, which is still standing today. Those color pictures are recent pictures. And the benefit of Soldiers and Sailors Memorial is, one, it's a giant resonating chamber, so you definitely get a live sound in there. The other is that the stage is out into the room. It's not recessed in a wall. It actually projects into the room. So you can put the orchestra out on the stage, as you see from the top right photo, and place your microphones and get a very lively kind of recording, which is what they wanted. On the first two LPs, they had this explanation of the recording and of finding Soldiers and Sailors Hall. Again, Command was never shy about marketing and about making claims in text. But basically, the approach they took was a 7-microphone approach initially, which was 3 microphones across the front. I suspect there was a fill-in mic probably back on the percussion or back on the brass. And I think there were 2 mics out in the hall. That's what it sounds like to me. Bob Eberens, who did later Command Classics recording, told me that he did it more 3 mics across the front, 3 mics out in the hall, that were about six to eight dB down from the front mics, so that you got hall sound, but it was less, and he was using his usual three mic approach. When Enoch Light produced the recordings, which was through 1965, he was definitely known to sit at the console and control dynamics and such, which is part of what he wanted to do. He believed that classical records should be exciting but not so dynamic that people need to go and adjust the volume control constantly. I think they still got very dynamic records. You can definitely hear on the LPs that they get loud and they do get soft. So, with that, let's go to the first cut on the CD, which is Brahms' Second. And I scanned all the packaging because I also wanted to show you how these records were packaged. This was heavy cardboard sleeve that then opened to the bottom right, and then the liner notes would be on the left. It was a gatefold, but the record tucked in from the inside. And even the record sleeve was heavy cardboard, as you can see in the center top. And they had the gold paper labels. So they definitely tried to do very classy-looking packaging with it. And this survived as long as Enoch Light was at the label, which was up through the 1965 sessions. They went to a regular gatefold in 66 and then went to much cheaper packaging later on. But let's play the first cut, please. And maybe we can make it a little louder than it's been. Okay, that was taken off the CD reissue of that MCA did in the early CD era. It's from a two-track tape that was mixed probably live from the three-track film when the original LP was cut. I don't know if you could hear it, but there's definitely some dropouts on that tape, so if this were to be reissued, it would be better to look for the film. I want to play you what a command session sounds like, although as Dennis said, we have somewhat of an Ivesian atmosphere in here with the overlapping sound from the other room. This is this will be from the film session reels from the Beethoven Sixth, and these reels definitely are in the archive right now. There's a certain amount of film still in the archive. It would be expensive to remaster it, but it could be done. This is just a short excerpt, just to hear how Steinberg communicates with the orchestra and what the hall sounds like, because you'll hear the PA speaker from the producer way back in the room. And so can we play cut two, please?
We're still rolling. Letter A into the fourth movement, B. 58B. Still rolling, 59B.
So I don't know if you could hear that, but basically Steinberg was telling the strings they weren't together, and then they kept rolling and started with the next take. I should note that Mike Gray was nice enough to provide me with some take sheets from the last session in 1968, and they were still doing hundreds of takes. So Steinberg was very patient about recording, apparently, very much a perfectionist. Very few conductors like doing things dozens and dozens of times, and very few orchestras like it. But, you know, these records are very precise. My opinion of Steinberg is very similar to Gary's. I would say he was definitely a student of Toscanini. You know, he's to the point, no nonsense. The orchestra was very good. The orchestra was polished. They're very fine recordings. The next thing I'm going to tie back in with Dennis a little bit, this is a later recording. Note the picture on the album. Dennis showed that before. So the PSO got a double dip out of the Porgy and Bess symphonic picture. And an interesting thing about these later albums, they claim to have some sort of a noise reduction system in use. It sounds to me like they might have been using Dolby with film, because there's on the original LPs, there's very, very little hiss. So, I mean, you know, like less hiss than usual from film. It's possible there were definitely Dolby units at Fine Recording when they first came out. So it's possible that that's their noise reduction. It's also possible that this was a marketing claim, that someone might have been turning down the treble when they were cutting the LP or something. So let's play the next cut, cut number 3, and then you can read the liner notes about that picture. Okay, this is just a quick photo from the last recording session that was done in Pittsburgh in 1968. The PSO had a really long and fruitful relationship with Robert Russell Bennett. He did many of these symphonic pictures. Their last one was My Fair Lady and the Sound of Music, that was commissioned specifically for the performing season and for the recording in 1968. They were still doing 35 millimeter. Ted Gossman had worked for Everest and then was hired by my father to work for Fine Recording, and he went out and did the last sessions. By that time, Bob Ebrins had left Fine Recording and was working in Hollywood. So these guys, In the back, they all went on to, the young guys went on to long careers in the audio business. Kenny Fredrickson ended up being the last owner of the Mix Place in New York. And Larry Dahlstrom worked for Phil Ramone and then had a mobile recording unit that made the Allman Brothers famous 1971 or 71 or 72 recordings at the Fillmore East that ended up on Eat a Peach. So interesting background on those guys. You also see Robert Byrne, who was the producer of the Command Classics after Enoch Light left. And just a quick rundown of the highlights. There were 23 albums released, and they got cheaper and cheaper looking once MCA took ABC in-house. The Shostakovich First, which is it's a fine recording of the music, and it's you know, a good performance, as was the Bruckner 7. Bruckner 7th, right. But the packaging on those 1970 releases is like the junkiest stuff. It looks like Pickwick stuff. it's really, I saw somewhere on the internet, Steinberg had some choice quotes about MCA and MCA's handling of the Command Classics catalog. They were not good corporate stewards. They put out a few CDs early in the era in cheap two CD packaging where they combined Command stuff with Westminster and Cap material.
Twofers.
Yeah, twofers. It was the twofer series. They didn't do an absolutely terrible remastering job, I have to say. So, you know, tapes do exist. I've been told that all the Command Classics tapes were called in to Europe so they did not burn up on the soundstage in Hollywood. It would be good to have them reissued, but, you know, based on my experience of working with film and working with old tapes, probably there would need to be a local donor or a foundation paying for the remastering. The good news is that's not a hard arrangement to make these days. As I said to the organization that just funded the remastering of Marcel Dupré's organ recordings for Mercury, all it takes is money these days. The record companies are not very proprietary about who they give credit to or anything like that. And you do get a professionally mastered box set out of it, a professionally produced one. It's not, there's lots of gray market stuff out there that I think looks really cheap and sounds cheaper. So it would be nice to see this PSO material remastered. I want to close with one more audio example tying into Dennis's. We'll hear some more Ride of the Valkyries. This is how the orchestra sounded in 1962. And this is actually, I dubbed this from a quarter track reel. So you can see that these things don't have to sound completely horrible. It definitely doesn't sound like a master tape. But let the Valkyries ride. And I will then pass it on to my friend Jim North, who will take the history forward. Thank you very much.